Well, thank you, Mary, for taking the time to meet with us. This is wonderful.
Sure. Well, thanks for coming over.
I normally would ask, you know, we normally do ask writers their first experiences in writing, but I got to ask you, were you a cut-up in science class?
I wasn't really.
I was not really.
There were lots of props for me. I can remember there was a monkey in fifth grade science class.
A live monkey?
A live monkey. Mr. Sonk had a live monkey. I was not a particularly engaged science student.
So then what were your first earliest experiences with the written word, either writing or reading or...
My dad was 65 when I was born, so he was always retired. So I kind of grew up in the library.
Yeah.
He'd go to the library, he'd be in the mystery, thriller, crime aisle, and I would be, I can picture, you know, the shelves where these books were. There was the Black Stallion series. I was a horse.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was a horse girl.
Yeah.
Pippi Longstocking, Harriet the Spy, girls going out and doing adventurous, you know, solving mysteries. And I don't know, what did Pippi Longstocking do? I don't really remember. Do you remember? What did she do?
Cute.
Tail braids. Yeah. I remember as being kind of an iconoclast. And the Tintin books. I loved... That was an early graphic novel. It was Tintin and the Professor. And they'd all go off on these adventures. There's one on the moon. There's one out on the South Pacific. And they're wonderful.
And Tintin was a dog?
A little guy with a hair very much like a Grandpa Max in the picture.
Yeah,
and he did have a little dog, Snowy.
Yeah.
And Snowy said, "Woa, woa." Which I guess is a French for woof, woof.
Yeah.
Originally a French. So I loved the Tintin books. I guess I had a bit of an appetite for adventure.
Were you a voracious reader?
When I was very young, I read a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so much later. You know, as I got into high school and college, I pretty much just read what I was assigned to read.
Yeah.
And then when I graduated, I went back to reading. But as a kid, yeah. Definitely. I love... I don't know if I was voracious.
Yeah.
I had a good appetite, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there any particular book that stands out?
Yeah, there's a book that's... it is so weird that I looked it up recently.
Yeah.
And I found it on, maybe Google Books or something.
Yeah.
And it's a very Mary Roachy book, too. It's called The Man Who Lost His Head. And it's a guy who literally wakes up in the morning and his head is gone... And he goes through the day trying on replacements. Like he takes a pumpkin. And he's wearing a suit. And he takes a pumpkin and he puts it on his head. And that's way too big. And then he puts the pumpkin aside. And he takes a parsnip and puts it on. And he puts the hat over the parsnip. And then he looks in the mirror and he says, "This is where I learned the word conspicuous." It's like it was far too conspicuous to go around with a parsnip as a head. And I don't remember the end of the book. I think he finds his head. I don't know.
Kafka meets Magritte.
Awesome. It's a very surreal book. It's very, you know, it's just kind of a play on, you know, he lost his head. I guess it's somebody thought, wouldn't it be funny to do a children's book where the guy really loses his head? And the drawings are just have stayed with me. I can picture the guy with a suit and a parsnip and a hat.
But you haven't gone out to eBay to buy this and again.
Oh, I didn't buy. No, I didn't buy. I took a look at it. I did. I was at a library once in the juvenile section, and I found it.
That's incredible.
I have looked through.
Okay, now what about storytelling?
Lost his head.
Were you a storyteller?
My dad was a story. My dad was a tremendous storyteller. Comes from, born in England, Irish background. Always telling stories, back-to-back-to-back stories.
Yeah.
You couldn't get him to shut up. And, of course, my brother and I and my mother had heard them all.
Back to where you were about storytelling.
Yes.
Did you write stories when you were a kid? Did you...
No, I didn't do much writing. I did writing that was assigned, but I never... I have actually... I would draw... I have a couple of books... They're here somewhere. One of them is called The Book of Penguins. However, there's a misspelling in the title. It's actually the book of Penguins.
Penguins.
Which I think this was probably second grade or third grade. Anyway, and I drew little penguins. I had this little way of drawing.
Yeah.
So there's the penguins in the supermarket and riding horseback and swimming. And I
wrote little... penguins riding horseback.
Yes, yeah, so okay. Penguins do it. Anyway, and I stapled it together, so that was my very first book.
Yeah. And you actually still have that. That's wonderful.
I have that, and there was one of the Book of Bugs. I have the Book of Bugs as well. Not a lot of text. Not a lot of plot.
Okay.
Character development, non-existent. So not a lot of storytelling in those books.
Then what the hell happened to you that you ended up as this bestseller storyteller?
Unemployment, graduation in the middle of a recession, no job skills to speak of. And I started out doing editing, copy editing, proofreading, and some commercial writing, public relations.
Mm-hmm.
I had a part-time job writing press releases and press materials for the San Francisco Zoo.
So, oh, neat.
Yeah, so that was fun.
Good one, yeah.
So then I started freelance writing half-time at the same time I worked at the zoo. It was something fun that I could do and get paid for. I had no other... real job skills.
Right.
Yeah. I had no intent of... I mean, I couldn't have imagined Stiff being a bestseller, but it was, for me, a... 15 years of magazine work and columns, and then that was kind of beginning to dry up.
Yeah.
And seemed like an auspicious time to move.
Well, how did you find that unique voice that you've got?
I don't know. I just... That, from the first several things that I had published, that was... And I guess it's just how I think. It's not a character I developed. It's just the raw goods. I don't know. It's just how it comes out on the page.
It's so unique and so much fun to read.
Well, thanks.
It really is. And not to mention, I have to say that. Just the idea of thinking of you're going to the University of Tennessee and stomping around in the garden there and having to wash your clothes for months afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Just the personal side to the science or the discovery is what makes it so intriguing, and to me at least, and to everyone, I think most of readers.
Well, and to me too, it's what I do is really just an excuse to satisfy my own curiosity.
Yeah.
It's a way to step into all these worlds that I find fascinating. And you know, people say, where do you go on vacation? Well, I don't take vacations. I travel a lot, and it's always in the service of a book, but the books are very much in the service of my curiosity.
Right.
So I tend to build the book around what would be an interesting and fascinating world to step into for a couple of years.
So I have to back up that curiosity. You didn't mention being a curious young lady as a child.
I think all kids are curious. I think that if anything, I just didn't box that up and put it in storage. I guess I still kind of have a 12-year-old boy's curiosity.
Yeah.
or girl, although I more often hear people comparing me to a 12-year-old boy. So I think everybody starts out delightfully curious and open to new experience
and full of wonder.
I think so. I don't think that the things that I write about, people say, you gravitate toward these weird things and these things that... You know, why would you be interested in? I'm like, no. I think that I'm writing about the things everybody's interested in until they realize they're not supposed to be interested in them.
Right.
Sex, death. Yeah, exactly.
Pooping.
Exactly. They're universal human experiences, and therefore I think that they're of interest to most people. I think that's why the books succeeded, because they're relevant to everyone in some way.
Yeah.
And I'm just giving people permission to be curious.
Yeah. How do you actually do your writing? I mean, do you use a laptop? Do you use a quill pen, cuneiform writing on clay tablets?
Yes, with the hammer. I have a laptop. Reporter's notebooks.
That's what I was fishing for.
I buy them by the brick.
Okay.
And I love, I don't know, I love those.
It's either that or yellow pads. Writers fall in one.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I love, when I first started out, that because I didn't have a journalism degree, the reporter's notebook was kind of this legitimacy. Look,
right,
I have a reporter's notebook.
Right, right.
I'm really a reporter.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to tell otherwise, but here's my credentials.
So you keep, do you keep journals?
No, I used to. I used to, when I would travel, when I was in my 20s, I kept journals.
Yeah.
Not very cryptic, boring, not, it just, things that I thought I'd read later and go, I remember that experience, and now I look at them and I have no idea, like, what, I don't know who those people were, I don't remember this. I wish I'd kept far more detailed journals.
Yeah, yeah.
Than I did.
Yeah. And so you keep up your notes?
Yeah, so, and I tape record if I'm interviewing somebody that, about it, something particularly complex, or if someone has a way of speaking that I want to capture accurately and not, and I don't think I'll be able to recreate it, I definitely keep the tape recorder on.
Yeah.
It's not always on because there's only so much you can transcribe.
Right.
But it's a combination. And then I'm writing. I come back, I transcribe my tapes. I always do that myself, even though it takes a long time.
Because you don't use a program to transcribe?
No, I want to hear it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings back being in the room and being in the place that I was.
Good.
And it helps refresh my memory.
Yeah.
So I always transcribe my own notes and interviews. And then I work from an ordinary manila file folder that has the transcripts of the interviews and whatever I've printed out or whatever I may need. So each chapter is one or two or three folders of materials, and they sit next to my desk, and I work from those, and I have a laptop. That's
and next thing you know, you're at a book signing in some bookstore.
Yeah, the calendar pages fly off the wall, and then I'm there eventually.
So do you go after the chapters and have it all plotted out, or do you go chapter by chapter when you do your research?
I have from the beginning, I'll make outlines, and they're comical. I save them because there's the first few weeks, there's a different one each week. And each one, I think, okay, now I know it's in this book. And then a week later, I realize this is ridiculous. That's not even, because I don't know what's out there in this world that I'm stepping into. I think I know, and then each person I meet tells me something else, and I hear about something new, and I junk something I thought I was going to put in the book. So for the first 6 months, I do have an outline, but it's constantly changing. And then at about 6 months or even 9 months, kind of gels, and I have a sense of what the chapters will be. I haven't, and I may be writing some while I have some that I've already reported that are yet to be written, some that I haven't reported. Usually, there's somewhere I've got to go to report, so I'm constantly juggling the setting up of things, the pestering of the people that I'll be visiting, the transcribing, the writing. So that's all going on at the same time. It's, you know, four or five things happening
and
at the same time.
Where in there, I mean, with your material, you've got to have an army of fact checkers. No? You're doing it on your own.
What I do is that when the manuscript is done, I send it to somebody in the field who has a broad expertise, and I have them read it and let me know where I've embarrassed myself and what's wrong. For Packing for Mars, for example, I found this guy who was a space historian, a licensed pilot, a former engineer at NASA. I mean, he was perfect. He covered all the bases. And I found him by looking on Amazon and reading some reviews of a book that had come out that had been savaged for its inaccuracy, and I found the politest man there, and I said, will you read my book, please? I will pay you for your time. And he was delightful and very, very helpful. So I try. So I'll do that with Gulp. I sent it to a gastroenterologist to go over and you know, just find the things that, and it's not the things that you think it'll be. It'll just be some random thing, like I describe scuba tanks as containing oxygen, and I know they don't. They contain
like air.
Yeah, and I just wrote, you know, oxygen, thinking, oxygen, air.
Yeah.
And then the public becomes your fact checker.
Yes. Oh, the cruel public.
No, they're very nice. Yeah. They're it's very rare that people write to you in a patronizing or you're such an idiot way. Yeah. It's often like, oh, I really enjoyed this book. I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, the hardback is almost like a working manuscript. And
yeah.
The paperback is the one that's...
Yeah.
There's invariably a few mistakes in the hardback.
That's great.
Interesting. Yeah. So it changes from hardback to paperback.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sometimes.
I didn't know that.
You want it to be stuff that's not going to change the page count.
Right.
So hopefully it's something you can address by adding a sentence, taking it out, or changing some words around. But yeah, there are definitely some tremendous differences between the advanced reader's copy and the hardback. That thing is a mess. Mine is.
Yeah.
A lot of people's are. I don't see any typos in them. My own are just tremendously embarrassing.
So you must have loads of people that come up to you. I'm going to guess, and you particularly, more than most writers, that come up to you and say, "I have the greatest idea for a book that you should write."
I get a bit of that.
Yeah.
I get a lot of ideas repeated over and over. A lot of people say sleep. You should do sleep or drugs. And they share a problem for me, which is it's an internal state, and it's not very much fun to describe. You know, you imagine somebody describing their dreams. You're like, yeah, okay,
yeah.
Shut up. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's just very dull. And someone describing an acid trip that they had or being... It's not, the science is, there's not a lot of stuff going on in a lab to describe or in the field. So it's mostly internal state, and that doesn't work for me, even though it's interesting science and they're interesting topics.
Yeah.
So over and over I get sleep, I get drugs, alcohol. Someone suggested that I write a book about the Antichrist. Who's the researcher? Where was that published? Someone else said you should write a book about the things that go on in high-rise apartment buildings. What's wrong with a low-rise apartment? What's going on the 10th floor that I don't know about? So I get some unusual suggestions, but I'm happy to get them because for me, the idea is always the hardest part.
Not to mention, imagine that in total, that there's got to be some sort of patterns that you can start to recognize about it, levels of interest or new areas.
Oh, another thing that people suggest, birth and pregnancy, which are good suggestions, but they've both been covered in fairly recently in books that I've, in fact, blurbed.
Right.
So I feel like they've been done and done very well.
Yeah.
Garbage. People suggest garbage. Elizabeth Roy did a wonderful book on garbage, so that's kind of been done. I mean, and all of these, I think people are dead on in terms of what would work for me.
Yeah.
It's just there's subtle things that they can't really know unless they live in my head.
Of course.
But yeah, people are wonderfully generous with their ideas.
Have you given advice to potential or prospective writers?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And what's the number one cardinal rule to a new writer that you give?
Oh, you know what? I give out this line. It's not mine, unfortunately. I think it's, you probably know whose line it is. And it's particularly relevant for nonfiction writers. And that line is, who said it? I mean, Elmore Leonard? I wish I could remember. Anyway, what he said was, Donald Barthelme, I've heard it attributed to, I leave out the parts people skip. And I think for nonfiction, that's really important. There's a tendency to be very comprehensive. And also, you know, if you spend a week at an archive, and you've spent this time getting there and doing the work, you feel very attached to that. But it may not be that interesting. And there's a tendency to want to put it in anyway. Or if you wrote it and you sweated over it, you don't really want to take it out. I tell people, if there's any kind of niggling doubt in your mind that this paragraph or this section is not really that fascinating, you know, just put it at the end of the file. Don't throw it away. It's always going to be there. If you want to put it back, you will never put it back.
Mm-hmm.
Pull it out. Just get it out of there. Put it in safekeeping. And
okay, your cutting room floor has got to be stuffed with grand, amazing things.
Not much. There's not really much there. There's not much. If it's good stuff, it goes in.
Okay.
It goes in. I have trouble filling a book. I don't ever have, 400 pages that needs to come down to 250.
Yeah.
It's always, I got 180 and I got to find another chapter. Because it's, I'm kind of picky about what goes in. It's really got to surprise people,
yeah,
or be something they're really curious about.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then I'll ditch it. And so there's some stuff that's, there's nothing good on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
There's a couple things that I'm like, oh, this has got to go in. And sometimes it'll end up in another book.
Okay.
So it rarely goes to...
Nothing's wasted.
Nothing is wasted.
Good. In the course of your career, you've seen some remarkable changes rapidly here. Publishing,
yeah.
E-publishing.
Yeah.
The technology parts, all the things. Where do you think our writing is going? Do you think it's going to be any different?
I sometimes talk to my agent in states of agitation and despair. And he says, Mary, the segment of the general population that reads books has always been small. Look at what it takes to be a bestseller versus, opening the numbers for a movie opening weekend. We're talking millions versus tens of thousands,
mm-hmm,
of sales per week.
Yeah.
It's always been a small number. They will always be there.
Yeah.
And I've kind of come around to seeing that. I think also that with e-books and electronic publishing, there was a sense of panic a few years back. How are the publishers going to survive? And how can this work in a way where they'll be able to be profitable? But it seems that they've kind of gotten a handle on it. And what they're losing per book, I think they make up an impulse purchase. Because when the price comes down, also, say... You're on the Daily Show, and you got all these millions of people seeing you. And in that moment, they go, "Oh, that sounds kind of interesting. It's only $8. I'm going to buy it." Whereas before, by the time they got to a bookstore and they saw your book a week later, they've forgotten. So there is this immediacy of here's someone talking about the book on radio or on TV, and now they can just take out their phone and or iPad and buy the book right there. So that's helped offset the losses per book. So I'm a little more hopeful that the business model can survive.
Sort of like the impulse aisle as you're checking out.
Yeah, exactly.
We now can do that with our phones. Okay,
yeah.
I have to ask. I mean, we all know about the Colbert bump. Did Jon Stewart give you the bump?
Are you kidding me? Straight to number 2.
Yeah.
On the bestseller list.
I mean,
wow.
You were brilliant on that program. He adored you.
For Gulp, it was, I have to say, though, it was one of those book publicity perfect storms in that it was The Daily Show the same day as Fresh Air aired.
Oh.
Fresh Air aired.
Oh.
So both those together, the book came in, I think it was number, I don't know, it was in the top 10, which is, for me, a rare and exciting thing.
Yeah.
So, yes, because Jon Stewart, bless his heart, he'll pick up the book, look in the camera and go, buy this book.
Right.
It's terrific. It's very funny.
Yeah.
It's not just like, nice, thank you for coming on.
Right.
It's people, buy this book, which is just tremendously helpful.
Chief, I have to tell you that your name rings more familiarity than probably any writer we've dealt with. And we've dealt,
Really?
Yeah. George R. R. Martin and Diana Gabaldon, really big writers. And they say Mary Roach, and everybody goes, really? Oh, she's so
really
wonderful. And yeah.
It's a broader spectrum.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
There are people, George R. R. Martin people, and there are the Jim Harrison people, and there are the sci-fi people.
These niches.
Yeah.
But you go across.
But you go across.
And so I went into Powell's, and because I've something I've never done with writers.
Yeah.
But I went into Powell's to see if I could buy a first edition of a Mary Roach.
Yeah.
And they said, I said, where can I find? He said, well, she's in this section and over in this section. You were all over the store. And not just in Powell's store.
Yeah.
You were in 3 different stores.
Yeah.
I went to the closest one, which happened to be Sex, and I bought a first edition of Boink that I want to have signed.
Of course.
So excited by that. But it was so fascinating to see that you were so spread around, unlike other writers that hit this niche,
right,
that's where they stay.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Yeah, no, that is neat. I don't think of myself as having very broad recognition because I you know, when every time you go online to book a flight or to buy, you know, to buy something, what's your name? I have never had someone go, "The Mary Roach." Am I talking to? I've never. People are like, "How do you spell that?" R-O-C-H-E. You know, never. I've never had any name recognition whatsoever. You know, I remember that scene in Is it in Being John Malkovich where he's ordering towels?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, like yes, in the periwinkle blue. You know, and I can't remember if he says his name, but anyway, I imagine someone definitely go, "The John Malkovich."
Yeah, right.
But not Mary Roach.
Well, you're not a football coach. If you were a football coach or a Kardashian,
exactly.
You'd be well known.
I'm not complaining. I'm perfectly happy that way. But that's interesting to hear.
Yeah. Going right back to just where you were, you had that great piece of initial advice for prospective writers.
Uh-huh.
What's anything more? Anything do you want to add?
Oh, okay, sure. Let's see.
Someone that has the promise and the dream of being a writer.
You know, so much of what I do depends on the research. The writing is only as good as the research, and I put far more sweat into getting myself to the place and the situation and the person that will become a really compelling chapter. So I encourage people, in nonfiction anyway, and fiction to a certain extent, to really pay attention and do everything you can to get yourself access to something that will be fascinating, compelling, funny, fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Because until I have that, until I've been there, found those people, been to that place, no matter how well I write, it's going to be crap. It's not going to be very interesting. Even though, you mean it's going to be well written? The writing's got to be good too. But I can't make the writing good without the legwork. And the that's the bulk
and
of work.
The
that's the hard work. Is it's a lot of time asking questions, turning over rocks, going to archives, looking through back issues, finding, just asking everyone, and then setting it up and getting permission. In my case, permission is always a challenge.
Yeah.
And that all falls into place, and if it's all there, it practically writes itself. You've got this wonderful material. It's a pleasure to write. It's not a struggle. But that's uniquely me. It's not... I think it's of relevance to most nonfiction writers, but, it's not just sitting down at a keyboard. It's all the months of work for me, literally months of haranguing people, cajoling them, going there, spending the time, following up, filling in the holes, all of that. It's fun for me. That's all fun stuff. But it has to be there for the writing to shine.
I mentioned this one earlier, but I was absolutely fascinated with your description about the gardens in the University of Tennessee. And now anyone could have described the place and could have done a very fine job of describing. What caught me up in your story was the smell on your clothing and shoes.
Yeah.
That made it so personal that suddenly the description wasn't as important anymore.
That
was brilliant writing.
Oh, well, thanks.
Really impressive. And you see that style that you do in most of the things where you bring in your own self, and even to the point of making fun of yourself.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I try to make fun of myself and not the people that I'm spending time with. I mean, humor is... I don't think people like mean... People don't like mean humor. I don't like to write mean humor, but I don't think people like to read it.
You know,
there are a couple of places where I had a little fun at someone's expense and... Because I couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
But it's very unusual.
The hit written messages at the tops of the ER places that should you die and go up there.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, no.
Kept waiting for you to say. And three people actually came back and said, "No, you let me down." They didn't.
They didn't. I know. That's a case where I was writing Dr. Grayson, the researcher, all the way through galleys. Anybody? Anything? Have you heard anything?
Yeah.
Has anyone remembered it?
Please.
You know, up to second. I can still put it in. Let me know if it happens this week.
Nah.
So, never did happen anyway.
Oh, well.
How did you evolve with the one-word titles?
just randomly, Stiff was on the book proposal, and I always thought, oh, I'll replace it, because I thought Stiff was too, a Stiff is kind of like, you know, criminal justice, the morgue, we got a Stiff in here, you know, a cadaver, a researcher, a medical researcher, someone in the sciences wouldn't use the word Stiff. I was being way too, let writers name their own books, because they're too deep in it. And things that just don't matter. I also fought against the cover, one of the best covers ever. I mean, Stiff is a fantastic cover. I fought, not particularly hard, but I fought against it because I said that it's too reminiscent of 6 Feet Under, the feet and the toe tag.
It feels
like it's a ripoff of 6 Feet Under, and so, you know, they ignored me, which was a very intelligent thing to do.
Yeah.
Titles and covers. Authors are, I think, not to be listened to in general.
Yeah, we're at the end of all the kinds of great things. You've been incredible, but I have to ask: is there anything you want to say or do? You know,
no. Whatever questions you have for me, I'm happy to answer. I have no soapbox needs.
Just a small book. Do you ever write here, or do you always go to the office?
No, when I need to write, as opposed to all that other, you know, calling and emailing and blah blah blah. When I actually need to write, I don't do it in my office that much. Sometimes I do. I go to a cafe often. There's a place in downtown Oakland that I like. It's got really good espresso. I'll sit there for a couple hours, and I'm more productive. The noisier and when there's music and people, it makes me focus. I do write here. Sometimes I'll sit there on the deck. Sometimes I'll sit in the living room. So I have done a fair amount of writing.
Mary, this has been wonderful.
Really, well, thanks.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Just a delight.
Yeah,
it's exciting both to get to meet you and to hear these remarkable insights about your stuff. It wouldn't be fair to ever ask where you're going next.
it's fair to ask, but
you aren't going to tell us.
No, I'm not.
In terms of a book or idea.
Oh, I am working on a book.
Okay.
I can say that much.
That's what everyone wants to hear.
There is a book in the work.
All right. It's exciting. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you.